materials. I will turn it over to Michelle Mahoney, again joining you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. I'm going to call up Michelle's materials, and Michelle, whenever you're ready, please go ahead and begin with the presentation.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Jean, for that introduction. So as Jean mentioned, this is part of a mining series of webinars that we've been doing for a few years now, and I wanted to show everyone our webpage that we have on EPA's Cleanup Information Network. The web link is here on this slide, where you can find more resources related to cleaning up mining sites. And you can also find a link to the archives of our previous webinars, and the link for this one will be on there once it's available. And as you know, as I mentioned, today's is part of a series. Here's a sampling of some of the webinars we've done in the past. We've done a bunch of case studies, and we have some webinars on heavy metals, cleaning up heavy metals at mining sites, ecological revitalization at sites, using biochar. This is just a sampling. There's a lot more topics you'll find if you go to the Mining Archive webinars. And as Jean mentioned, today's presentation is going to be on revegetation of mine waste in arid environments. And we have two speakers today. We have Julie Nelson, and you can see her biography here. She'll be presenting along with Raina Mayer from the University of Arizona. Again, you can see her biography here. Their contact information is on these slides and also available with the archive of this webinar. So with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Raina. We do ask that you ask questions, type your questions in the Q&A pod as the speakers are talking. And when we get to the Q&A session of the session, which will be at the end, your questions will be all ready for us to ask the speakers. So with that, Raina, it's all yours.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. I hope this finds you all well during this very challenging time, and I thank you for taking time to listen to this webinar. I also want to say thank you to Josie Torres, Michelle Mahoney, and Jean Ballant for inviting us to give this webinar and for making the whole presentation process seem easy. So today, Julie Nelson and I will be talking about our work on revegetation of mine waste sites. I'm going to focus on legacy sites, and Julie will focus on active mining sites. Up front, I'd like to acknowledge that much of this work was funded by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program, and thank them for their support. In today's talk, I will first describe the extent of the problem, revegetation, and then talk in detail about our field legacy site. And then Julie's going to take over and describe how the work she leads at several operating mining sites and the partnership we have developed with several mining companies. So residual mine waste is arguably the largest waste stream globally. There are 2 to 3 major mine tailings dam failures each year that result in profound environmental damage and, in some cases, loss of human life. Very recent failures have given the mining industry and investors pause. New thoughts and guidance have just been released by a partnership between the ICMM, which is the International Council on Mining and Metals, UNEP, the UN Environmental Program, and PRI, Principles for Responsible Investment. Vale, which owns the Córrego do Feijão mine in Brazil, has recently come out with a request for information future of tailings call. To address some of the failures that they've had. But I also want to emphasize that revegetation is only one component needed for the management of mine waste sites. This type of management requires really complex science and engineering solutions, but revegetation is the component of the solution that this talk will focus on. So In reclaiming mine waste sites, traditionally we have used something called cap and plant. And cap and plant is when you emplace a full topsoil cover that can range from 6 inches to 3 feet in depth. That is then seeded, and vegetative growth occurs where the plant roots may or may not actually go into the mine tailings. This cap is meant to physically isolate the mine tailings from the environment. And in terms of long-term management, erosion processes can occur, and it needs to be looked at and re-examined over time. In contrast, phytostabilization seeks to employ soil amendments that are mixed in with the mine tailings. And then the mine tailings are seeded so that the plants grow actually in the mine tailings. So you're actually trying to improve the soil and plant supporting qualities of the mine tailings. Basically, that, as we'll see in the talk today, this can work well for periods of time, but it also has long-term management issues. As you're trying to transition these mine tailings into some materials that support plant growth better. The idea here is that you more permanently stabilize the mine tailings material against wind and water erosion. So our field site is the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site in central Arizona. This mine was closed around 1960, and the tailings are highly acidic, and they contain high levels of metals such as arsenic, lead, and zinc. The wind direction at this site is primarily going from the left to the right in the slide, and so over the years, dust has blown into the neighboring community, requiring some yard removal. The Iron King tailings are pyritic in nature. As I mentioned already, they have low pH, they have high metal content, but from a revegetation standpoint, another big issue is that they have very poor soil characteristics. They completely lack organic carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. They lack soil texture and water holding capacity, and so they do not support plant growth. On the left, you can see a picture of the tailings from 1950, and on the right, you can see one that we took in 2008. And other than the fact that one picture is in black and white and the other is in color, they really don't look much different. So in 2010, we established a phytostabilization field trial on the site. And this field study was based on preliminary greenhouse studies and examined compost-assisted direct planting. And so if you look at the field site itself, you can see this is a Google Earth image of the plot, which we call phase one. And we have six treatments in this plot, each replicated four times. We looked at three different compost amendments, 10, 15, and 20. We looked at it with seeds and without seeds, but frankly, the plots without seeds received seeds from the neighboring plots, and so really I'll be talking about the first four treatments. So these are the results of the canopy cover. The percent canopy cover is on the y-axis, and the compost amendment rate is on the x-axis. And if you look at the colors going from red to blue for each of the compost amendment rates, these are the years of the study going from 2010 to 2015. I'd like to draw your attention to the dashed line. That shows a 30% canopy cover, which is the off-site vegetation shown in this picture right here. So what you can see is that the 10% compost amendment resulted immediately after 5 months in a 30% canopy cover. And over the years, that declined steadily, although not significantly. Similarly, the 15% compost amendment achieved a 30% plant cover, and it seems to stay a little more stable than the 10%. The 20% compost amendment reached 30% in 5 months, but then jumped up to about 50%. But then it almost appears, although not significant, that the canopy cover declines a little bit in these later years. So the results show that a single application of compost immediately increased the pH and improved levels of nutrients. We were excited that our greenhouse results scaled effectively to the field for all of the key parameters we were measuring. But what we found was that although the compost transitioned this highly disturbed matrix into a substrate that was able to support plant germination and growth for this 6 years, we could visibly see places where erosion and ponding had accelerated local acidification processes, indicating that the remediation would have to be monitored and perhaps supplemented with further compost additions over the long term. And I would, okay. So we wanted to understand whether the vegetation that we established at this site could actually suppress dust emissions from the site. And this is a really great video that Mackenzie Russell, a graduate student in atmospheric sciences, took for us. And you can see that the particles are jumping and bouncing and then are lofted into the air. And you can see these big clouds of dust forming and moving substantial distances along the tailings, resulting in local transport. And so this really illustrates the problems of dust emission from this type of mine tailings. My video is kind of stopping and starting. So I'm just going to end it. Okay, thank you. So we did a study to measure the dust flux on the site. And this study was done by Juliana Gil-Loeja. She set up four different plots on the site. One of them, was an unirrigated control. The second, an irrigated plot down in this corner. The third, a sparsely vegetated plot, about 16% canopy cover. And the fourth had a canopy cover of about 30%. She put passive samplers on all corners of this plot and collected dust for approximately 1 year. And the result of the dust flux shows on the y-axis here the average dust flux in grams per meter squared per year versus the treatment. And you can see there was a net emission of dust in the unirrigated control as well as in the irrigated control. However, in the two vegetated plots, both the sparsely and more fully vegetated plot, you had a net deposition of dust, indicating that the vegetation, the leaves on the vegetation, is actually trapping dust as it moves over the plot. We were able to also measure metals that were associated with the dust that was collected here. And so this plot shows the arsenic content and sort of mimics the dust flux plot, with arsenic being emitted from the site in the control, the irrigated control, and the sparsely vegetated plot, but it is actually removed from the dust, deposited as dust in the more fully vegetated plot. So I would like to now transition to the real purpose of this talk, which is to discuss how the below ground performance at Iron King is related to the above ground success or failure, and how this has made us approach the revegetation process a little bit differently. And to me, it boils down to this is a story of warring microbes. And so if you think about it, mine tailings such as we see at Iron King, these highly acidic mine tailings that have been around and unchanged since 1950, are a stable and healthy environment for acidic microbial communities. The energy for these microbes is supplied by reduced iron and sulfur in the pyritic ore. So these are not organisms like you and I that eat Cheerios and Wheaties and organic matter. These are organisms that actually use reduced iron and sulfur and oxidize them for energy for growth. And so the biogeochemistry of pyrite dissolution is that when we scrape off the topsoil and remove plants and expose pyrite ore, shown in this FeS2, to oxygen, what happens is that you slowly oxidize and release iron as iron 3, and in the presence of oxygen, you generate acid. So the iron 3 oxidizes the sulfur. And in addition, the iron 2 that is reduced from iron 3 can be regenerated again. This regeneration happens slowly, abiotically, above pH 4.5. But as the pH declines, increasingly, microbial populations can do this regeneration, living off this iron oxidation. And it goes faster and faster as the pH declines. So when you expose these sulfide ores to oxygen, you get this release, you get generation of acid, the acid dissolves metals, and you release all of this into the environment, getting this sort of, these sort of ugly looking pictures on the right side. Further, plants do not grow at less than pH 5. And this situation can last for decades to centuries. And so if you don't want to have environmental impacts, such as shown here, you need to manage it. And so I would like to tell you some of the work that John Hottenstein, a graduate student, did to look at this case of warring microbes, the acidic microbes versus the plant growth promoting microbes that are added with compost at the Iron King site. And so I want to point out here, after 1 year, we had a very nice stand of plants right here. But then after 3 years, you can see this localized development of areas that plants are starting to struggle or failing completely. And so that's what we were curious about. Why is that happening? So we set out to understand the dynamics of the microbial community in this acidic mine tailings following a compost addition and planting. So we used both the Iron King field trial. Additionally, John performed a microcosm experiment to actually identify the microbial taxa that were involved in developing and maintaining acidic conditions. So this is the field study design. I've showed it before. The call out here is looking, the stars are actually where the core samples came from that were analyzed for the data that I'm going to show you. The soil cores were collected in 2010 to 2014 and again in 2016. We measured a bunch of geochemical parameters, but I'm going to talk about pH and plant cover here. And I'll talk about the microbiome, which was analyzed by ITAG sequencing of the 16S gene. So if you look at the taxa that came out of all of the samples that John analyzed, he did a principal coordinate analysis of those taxa, and there is a significant difference among the five groups that are represented in this graph here. So they naturally divided into these five groups, and if you look at the comparison between the five groups, so if you look over on the right here, on the x-axis we have group number, and on the y-axis up here we have pH, you can see that it's a function of group. The pH started at about 4 for group 1, goes up a little bit, and then for groups 3 to 5, the pH declines. Plant cover mimicked that pattern, with group 1 being at about 30% plant cover, it jumps up a little bit, and then groups 3 to 5 decline. I'm going to switch now and show you a cluster or tree analysis of the data shown in this graph. So these two pieces of information are identical, they're just shown differently. And going to move to my most complex slide, which is this one. So here you see the tree or cluster analysis on the left. Let me draw your attention to the very right-hand side, which is the sample distribution. And this one shows where the taxa came from, which sample year the taxa each came from. So as you can see for group 1, all of the samples that group 1 taxa were in were collected in 2010 and they were never seen again. For groups 2 through 5, you can see that none of the taxa came from the 2010 samples, but are distributed between 2011 and 2016. And the interesting thing is that the majority of the taxa come from samples collected in 2016, for example, from group 5. So as you go from group 2 to 5, more and more of the samples come from later and later sampling times. So I'm going to now hide the middle part of this graph, and I want to focus on the left part of this graph. John looked at the most dominant organisms in this tree, and he divided them into whether they were acidic iron or sulfur oxidizers or plant growth promoting microbes. And so these are the dominant, on the left here, these are the dominant iron and sulfur oxidizers. The color relates to their abundance. So the whiter the color, the less abundant, and the greener the color, the more abundant. And what you can see is that the green color gets more and more intense as you go from the top to the bottom of this slide, or from group 1 to group 5. Indicating that as time goes on, since group 5 was collected later in the study, you know, in 2013, 14, and 15, we have higher and higher abundances of these acidophilic organisms. Now, if I uncover the middle part and we look at the plant growth promoting microbes, you can see that in the first, for the first three groups, and the first part of this study, the plant growth promoting organisms dominate. This is all green. And then suddenly, they disappear. And so this is what made me think of this as a lore, that once after you add the compost, these plant growth promotings dominate and suppress the iron and sulfur oxidizers, but at some point they cannot compete anymore and they lose the war to the iron and sulfur oxidizers. John also did a microcosm experiment to look a little more carefully at the types of microorganisms involved in this war process. So he designed these microcosms, which are sand and clay. He amended the microcosms either with iron or sulfur or a combination of iron and sulfur, and he inoculated it with mine tailings. He sampled every 2 weeks and looked at the iron and sulfur oxidizing communities. So he did two experiments. I'm not showing you the first one. The first one simply showed that the reactions we're talking about are biotic, not abiotic. But in the second one, he created two different pH conditions for each treatment, iron, iron sulfur, or sulfur. And the pH treatments were either extremely acidic, pH 2.5, or moderately acidic, pH 4.5. And he was able to maintain those conditions, those pH conditions, for the duration of this 8-week experiment. And when he looked at the taxa that were associated with these two conditions, you can see in this plot that the highly acidic taxa are significantly different than the moderately acidic taxa. You're probably not surprised at that. And he further looked at exactly who was involved in the moderately acidic versus highly acidic conditions. And these four taxa are involved in the moderately acidic conditions. And let's see, there should be, yeah, oops. And these three taxa are involved in the highly acidic conditions. And so these two experiments, the field and the microcosm experiment, allowed us to come up with an explanation for what happens in this food chain and what happens over these several years where you see acidification conditions encroaching on these healthy plants. Under moderately acidic or neutral conditions, after you add the compost, you have a lot of organic matter. And organic matter actually inhibits the growth and metabolism of highly acidic chemoautotrophs that live on iron and sulfur oxidation. So these moderately acidic organisms here that are chemoheterotrophic, like you and I are, serve to scavenge the organic matter that's present, the compost that you added. And then you transition into a mixotrophic community. And mixotrophs can either be heterotrophic or they can be autotrophic. And they serve to scavenge the remaining organic matter. And so now you've created conditions where no organic matter available is available or left, and the highly acidic chemoautotrophs can dominate and thrive. And in fact, when John took all of the taxa that he identified in his microcosm study and plotted them against pH, he found that they are a very strong predictor of what the field pH was at Iron King. And so this says that these organisms can serve as biomarkers of is your system approaching a point where you're going to have to manage it, where you're acidifying and are going to have problems. And that is versus doing the same analysis with the two familiar acidophiles that are generally written about in the literature, and we see these often because they are the community that is left after the acidification process is complete. So in conclusion, mine tailings acidification is a very complex process. It can be controlled by organic matter addition, and we would argue that if you want to do cytostabilization at a site like Iron King, it's going to take management and perhaps reapplication of organic matter for some period of time. We think that the tailings microbiome is a really good biomarker of mine tailings status and fairly easy and cheap to measure. And that the combined insights of these below ground metrics with the above ground growth are better markers to use for guaranteeing long-term success of mining reclamation. And so let me transition now into the next part of the talk. We talked extensively with mining companies about these results, and they were very, very interested. And they were very interested in trying to apply it to some of the problems they have with active mining operations. And so we started something called the University of Arizona Center for Environmentally Sustainable Mining to try and translate the fundamental research that I just showed you into practice. And Dr. Nelson is going to take over and tell you about that work.
Hello, my name is Julie Nelson, and I want to welcome all of you to this webinar. And like Raina Mayer, I want to thank EPA for organizing the webinar and for facilitating our presentations this afternoon, or this morning, depending on where you are. For the second half of this talk, I'm going to change gears, and I am going to look at the below and above ground dynamics of revegetation in active mining sites rather than in legacy sites. You will see some of the same patterns, but also different variables that we look at. The major challenge when we talk about modern mining operations is the footprint that we're talking about. And these two Google images were taken of mine sites in southern Arizona. And we are dealing with the sites of excavation in the bottom picture. Let me just get control of my... I don't have control of my cursor. Let me see if I can get it. Oh, there, I got it. Thank you very much. Okay, now I have control of my cursor. These are open pits, so if you're talking about a surface mine, there's a large amount of area where the ore is excavated, but we also have the large surface area where the waste, which is a byproduct of mineral excavation, is deposited. And for one example, in this site, these squares up here are mine tailing storage facilities. And this one is about 600 acres in size, just to give you an idea of the magnitude if you're not familiar with hard rock mining. This one down here is about 400 acres in size. And so we're dealing with very large land areas that need to be reclaimed or recovered after mining operations are done. So we have two different types of mine waste that we talk about. Mine tailings, which is what Raina was speaking about in the first part of this talk. This is a tailings dam in the upper, the picture on the upper left-hand side over here. And basically, copper ore in most areas where it is being mined is less than 0.5% of the concentration of the material that's excavated. So there's a large amount of the material that is excavated and then extracted that then has to be deposited as waste. And basically the rock is pulverized, simplistically speaking. It's pulverized, the copper is extracted in a wet process so that you end up with a slurry, and that slurry is piped out into these mine tailing storage facilities, like the one pictured here at the top. And so that is a very fine particle size and a very large acres. Like I said, they can be 400, 600 or more acres in size. The other type of waste that we deal with is waste rock. And this picture down here on the bottom is a waste rock dump. And basically, this is the material that had copper concentrations too low for economic extraction. And in contrast to the tailings, we have a very coarse material here. And both of these are types of waste that we would hope to revegetate during the process of mine site reclamation. So why do we want to reclaim these sites, and what are our research objectives in terms of working on these sites? The top picture on the right is showing you a modern mine site equivalent to what Raina showed you earlier with the dust emissions. This is a retired tailings dam, and you can see that the tailings are, this gray material is extremely fine, and when the wind blows, that dust is transported off-site. And it can cause respiratory complications for people with asthma, emphysema, or any other respiratory issue. So it may not, in most times with modern mine operations, it doesn't contain heavy metals, so it's not a matter of metal toxicity, but it's more just the dust issue. And so that dust needs to be contained. On the bottom right, you see a picture of a very successfully reclaimed mine tailings storage facility, and you can see we have a diverse ecosystem here. And the goal in terms of research is to develop more effective and efficient revegetation tools so that we can return these large areas of mine waste to productive ecosystems. And that may be for some kind of economic recovery, such as grazing, but it could also just be for carbon sequestration. We want to create ecosystems so that land is returned to some kind of ecological productivity. And we want to address this process in active mine sites so that we facilitate a consistent ecosystem regeneration. Because what we have seen in all the sites that we've worked on is that you may get as low as a 50% recovery, and I mean 50% success rate, I should say, and for different reasons than the ones that Raina discussed earlier in her presentation. But I will go through the insights that we've gained on working on these sites. So what I'm going to do in my part of the talk is to present two case studies. And the first case study is the revegetation of a mine tailing storage facility. And in the second case study, I will talk about the revegetation of a waste rock slope so that you can see both the differences between the two different issues of mine waste reclamation. So here, the standard technology, as Raina mentioned earlier, for mine tailings recovery is to cap the tailings with a soil cap prior to seeding. And that can be, as Raina pointed out, anywhere from 6 to 36 inches in depth. And the purpose of this soil cap initially is to contain that dust. Put the soil on, contain the dust until you get those plants growing. And the rationale in deciding the depth, it really has to do with the chemistry of the tailings. If the tailings are acid-generating, like the kind of pyritic ore that was at the Iron King mine, then you need a deep cap to protect those tailings from oxidation and from transport. If you are just trying to contain the dust and give the seeds a germination matrix, then we have worked on sites with caps as little as 6 inches in depth. And that's part of our interest in research, is the depth, the importance of that depth of that soil cap. The seed mix is typically a mix of native species, grasses, shrubs, and trees, and they are applied either by drill application, if it's a drill seed application, if it's a flat surface, or hydro seeding if we're talking about slopes. So what are the challenges in accomplishing this process in arid and hyper-arid, arid and semi-arid regions? As Raina pointed out, hard rock mining, actually I'm not sure if she pointed this out, but hard rock mining typically occurs in many arid and semi-arid regions of the globe where precipitation is limited and evapotranspiration is high. So it's a real challenge for plant growth. In addition, the material is basically pulverized rock, whether we're talking about tailings or waste rock, so it's got a very low nutrient content, and it has very low water holding capacity. The other challenge is that if we're talking about 400 to 600 acres of land area and we need to cap it with 12 inches of material, that is a lot of soil that needs to be excavated, sourced from some site off-site of the mine. And the capping material that they source has variable quality. And as you're going to see in this presentation, we see that that is a significant variable that we need to understand better. The last point in the challenge is we need better metrics of revegetation progress, because we really don't understand why when we seed 500 acres, we get 250 acres of good growth and 100 acres of very poor growth. So we want to understand that process in a more mechanistic fashion. So our research focus, very similar to the first part of this talk, is to develop below-ground biogeochemical indicators to be used as predictive tools by the mining industry, both to assess that initial soil cover or soil cap quality, and also to gain a more mechanistic understanding of that revegetation progress. So the first site that I'm going to look at is a 600-acre tailing storage facility that was capped with 12 inches of soil. It was drill seeded with a mixture of a very complex mixture of perennial grasses, forbs, shrubs, and trees. And this data that I will be presenting in the next couple of slides was a site evaluation that was done 5 years after seeding. And what I would like you to do is look at these two pictures. On the bottom left, we have the southwest portion of this tailings facility, and on the bottom right, we have the northwest portion. And as you can see, the vegetation establishment is drastically different. We have shrubs, grasses, a mixed plant community on the southwest side. On the northwest side, we barely have grasses surviving. And if you look at the table on the right and focus in on the two rows, I'm just going to show you two parts of this to simplify the data. If you look at the two rows that are highlighted in red, the northwest had a percent plant cover of 17%, and the southwest had a percent plant cover of 42% when we did our site evaluation. And the letters to the right of the numbers show that there's a statistically significant difference, that the southwest had significantly more vegetation cover than the northwest. And this work is being done by our graduate student, Lydia Jennings, in conjunction with a technician, Catherine Fontana, in our group. So then we wanted to look at the below-ground soil indicators to see if we could get any indication of why there was such a drastic difference in these two areas of the mine tailings facility. There are a number of different indicators that we look at when we're looking at active mine operations. Some of them are similar to what was presented earlier, and then we look at other things as well. And they fit into three categories. Biological, we look at DNA biomass, and this is a DNA extraction from the soil where we look at all of the bacteria, archaea, and fungi in the soil, as well as some plant material. We can also then just quantify in a molecular way the bacterial abundance. We can look at microbial diversity, which you saw some slides on microbial diversity earlier. We can look at the community composition. Chemically, we can look at the pH, the electrical conductivity, which is a measure of salinity. We can look at total nitrogen content, organic carbon, bioavailable phosphorus. These are all very important plant nutrients. And physically, we look at soil texture analysis, and we look at the particle size distribution. In this particular study, we looked at a subset of these below-ground indicators, but the two that correlated most strongly with plant cover were the two you see here on the right, total nitrogen and DNA biomass. So if we look at total nitrogen first, and again, we'll just focus in on the northwest and the southwest sections that had the statistically different plant cover, you can see that the total nitrogen was 0.165 milligrams per gram of material, whereas in the southwest area, it was almost double that at 0.311. And again, the letters on the right show you that the southwest had statistically higher nitrogen content than the northwest. And if you look down below the table, you can see that the native desert soils in this area had a total nitrogen content of 0.46. So the southwest area really was reaching what we would say is an ecosystem fertility level that was approaching that of the native soils. If you move over now and look at the DNA biomass on the right, again, we see a very similar pattern. We see that in the northwest side, we had a level of DNA biomass around 300 nanograms per gram of dry material, which was 8 times lower than what we saw on the southwest side. And once again, if you look at the DNA biomass bullet at the bottom, the native soil had a DNA biomass of 2,900 nanograms DNA per gram of soil, which is just slightly higher than the 2,500 that we were seeing in the southwest area. So basically what we're showing with this, if we take a snapshot 5 years after seeding, we have one corner of this tailings facility that is reaching a below-ground fertility level approaching that of a native desert soil, whereas we have another area where it's lagging far behind. And so the below-ground and above-ground showing a similar pattern. We also wanted to look at the nature of the plant community, because if you're going to get a stable ecosystem, you need to look at the plant community composition. So we went back and looked at that site 10 years after seeding, and if you look at this graph in the upper left corner, pink is forbs, green is grasses, and blue is shrubs. And once again, we're just going to look at the northwest and the southwest side of this data. And in the northwest, you can see a community dominated by grasses with a very low amount of shrubs. And if you move over to the southwest, which is the far side of this graph, the community is dominated by shrubs with a low level of grasses, a low level of forbs. And this is more similar to what you would see in the surrounding desert area, where we have desert. The desert vegetation is dominated by mesquite and acacia trees, an assortment of cacti and shrubs. So that southwest community, in summary, the metrics that are associated with robust plant establishment are both below and above ground. Below ground, we see a higher level of soil nitrogen and biomass developing, and above ground, we see a plant community that's transitioning to one that's dominated by shrub cover. The other thing we learned from this analysis is that the cover material, I forgot to say in the earlier slide, we learned from the mine that the borrow pit where the soil capping material was excavated for both the northwest and southwest side of this tailings dam was from the same borrow pit, but the northwest was lower subsurface material, where the southwest cover material came from near surface material. So the cover material was different for the two areas of this mine. So basically our conclusion is that the cover material source impacts the rate of plant establishment. And we would imply that the quality was different. And so we need to understand the metrics that should be measured that when evaluating cover material. And these pictures on the right demonstrated that again. This is a different tailing storage facility with a very similar pattern. The picture in the top, these pictures were taken 5 years after seeding on this particular tailing storage facility. And the picture on the top is the northern side of that tailings facility, and the picture on the bottom is the southern side. They were capped with presumably the same cover material, and they were seeded at the same time with the same seeding mix. So once again, we need to go in at this site, we need to evaluate the below ground metrics, we need to try to understand why nothing grew at on the southern side of this tailings facility. And one of the things that we would really like to do with this research is to, as I said, develop a more mechanistic understanding so we don't get this dichotomy. We don't get this pattern where there's a 50% success rate in revegetation. So moving on to case study two, we want to look at the revegetation of a mine waste rock dump. And this is a slope of a waste rock slope that was seeded in 2012. There was no soil cover placed. It was hydroseeded. And there was a seed mix that had 6 perennial grasses, 3 perennial forbs, and 4 shrubs. And in this picture on the right, the slope, the part of the slope that's labeled the D slope below the white dot hashed line is the area that was seeded. And the part that was labeled N above this line is the area that was not seeded. And so this study has given us a perfect opportunity to compare the effect of seeding to an area that was not seeded. And this picture was taken about 5 years after seeding, and what I'd like you to observe as you think about the data in the next few slides is that nothing is growing on the upper slopes. So if you don't seed in the semi-arid, harsh environment, in the short term, you're not going to get any kind of plant establishment. What I'd like you to observe on the lower part of the slope is that we have very inconsistent plant establishment. We have some areas, as you can see here, that indicated by the arrow, where we have a lot of shrubs growing, and then we have other areas that are fairly bare. And so we would like to understand why do you get this pattern in plant establishment. This work was done by Leah Osana, who's a technician in our lab, Karen Serrano, who is an undergraduate researcher, and Catherine Fontana, who is a research technician in our group. So the first thing I'd like to show you is the initial below-ground composition of this material. Since we're going to, in this study, I'm going to give you the opportunity to see how the below-ground chemistry and biology changes over a five-year period. And we are going to compare the seeded D slope to the unseeded N slope. And what I'd like you to see in the area up here that is boxed in red is that there's no significant difference in pH, in electrical conductivity, in total nitrogen, or in DNA biomass between the unseeded and seeded areas at the beginning of our study, which was in 2014. One thing I'd also like you to notice is how high the pH is in this material, 9.2. Now, plants prefer circumneutral pH for the best growth. And one of the reasons for this is, in terms of high pH, is that nutrients are more available. Phosphorus, for example, which is a very important plant nutrient, precipitates as calcium phosphate at these high pH levels. And so at high pH, you have less nutrient availability for plants. The second thing I'd like you to look at is a comparison of these values to the offsite. And if you look down here, this picture on the bottom left is what the offsite vegetation looks like in this area. And one thing that's interesting, it's a very rocky soil. So in terms of the percent fines, which are the chemically and biologically active portion, they're really pretty similar between the offsite and the waste rock. So the rockiness of the waste rock is not a huge problem. The other thing I'd like you to see is that the values that we're looking at here, pH, EC, total nitrogen, and DNA biomass, are significantly higher in the offsite area. So this is a look at the plant community composition, how it changes over the 5 years that we studied it. If you look at the first part of this graph on the left, this is what the undisturbed site, this is our natural site, looks like. It has an average of a 44% cover. It's dominated by shrubs with a lower percentage of grasses. So as you can see, very similar to what we observed at the other site. Now moving to the part of the graph in the middle, you can see the progress on the seeded slope. If we look at 2014, which is the bar right here on the left-hand side, the community was dominated by grasses and forbs. And at that time, it had a cover of about 12%. If we move right along these bar graphs, by the time we get to 2018, you can see that the shrub composition has increased significantly. And the total plant cover increased to 33%, so it was approaching that of the undisturbed site. And the relative percentage of the shrub cover in the whole community changed from 4% to 43%. So we see this similar transition of grass to shrubs. If you look over here at the end slope, you can basically see the plant cover never increased above 10%. And generally, these are mostly annuals that are going to grow up in forbs that grow up and they die after a season. So this is the dynamic that we're looking at over a five-year period, and we now want to transition to looking at what that looks like below ground. If you look on the right-hand side, the graph on the right-hand side, I'm going to show you nitrogen over the five-year period. The purple bars, or box plots, are the unseeded end slope, and the orange box plots for nitrogen are the seeded slope. And what I'd like you to observe as you look at this data is, first of all, the purple boxes stay relatively the same size as you move across the 5 years. And what the size of the box is in terms of the vertical size of the box, as you can see from top to bottom, that shows you the variability in the data. So if the box is small, then there's a very small variability between data points. And what we did was we ran transects across the whole length of that lower slope so that we could sample across the slope and see the variability. By 2018, we really don't get a significantly higher level of nitrogen in the seeded slope compared to the unseeded slope right here. However, you can see that the size of the box is quite large, meaning that we have high variability. So think back to that picture I just showed you about how we have concentrations of plants and then we have large open areas. So basically what we hypothesize is that where the plants are growing, the nitrogen is building up. Where there's no plants, it's remaining like the unseeded area. If you look over here at the right-hand side with biomass, you see a similar trend. the interesting thing is that we end up by 2018 getting significantly higher levels of biomass in the over here in the seeded area as compared to the unseeded area. And the unseeded, the biomass just remains very low, consistently low. So biomass appears to be a more rapidly changing below ground indicator of plant establishment. And the nitrogen seems to be a more conservative indicator. Both of these values are still significantly lower than the off-site values. The off-site nitrogen values are 1.6 milligrams nitrogen per gram of soil, so we have a long way to go to reach that. DNA biomass is 6,800 nanograms DNA, and as you can see, we are approaching 500. So we are trending up, but we still have ways to go to reach the fertility of an offsite. So Leah Osana decided that she really wanted to do a targeted study looking at the specific effect of shrubs and grasses, because as I showed you in the last graph, we have high variability across this slope. So if we really want to understand how plants drive fertility increases, we decided to do a targeted study. So the initial, this is a lot of data to look at, but what I want you to focus in on is the red arrow that shows you what the plant fertility looks, the soil fertility looks like below the shrubs. And what you can see of all these parameters that we looked at, the shrubs have created a significant increase. So if we go down the list, organic carbon is tenfold higher than the, compare this area, the shrub to the unseeded end slope over here. You can see organic carbon significantly higher, bioavailable phosphorus is significantly higher, total nitrogen, biomass, each of these parameters, bacterial abundance. Again, the diversity of both bacteria and fungi are tenfold to higher, and also the capacity of nitrogen cycling. And the interesting thing to notice is if we look then at the grass-influenced soils over here, we see that the biological components, which are highlighted down here in green, are significantly improved over the end slope, but the chemical fertility parameters don't show a significant increase. So as we saw with nitrogen earlier, the nitrogen or the chemical buildup is a slower process. It's a more conservative estimate than the biological. The other thing to notice is that when the shrubs get established, they accelerate that fertility development more quickly than the grasses. So then I'm going to show you just a few of these microbial community composition plots as you looked at it, as you saw in the earlier part of this study. These are NMDS, so a slightly different way of doing it, but each of these points, single points, represents a full microbial community. And the bluish purple points are the unseeded area, and the other colors are the planted areas. And so what you can see right off the bat is the microbial community that is typical of the waste rock is completely different from that the community that is established, that develops once plants are established. And 33% of the variation between all these communities is explained simply by where we took the samples. This is the community up here, these dark green dots, which represents the undisturbed site. And once again, you can see the lime green is the shrubs, and the grasses are the pink, so that the biological community of the grasses is different from the biological community of the shrubs, but they're both trending towards the undisturbed site and away from the waste rock. The next slide is looking at the same thing with fungi, and as you can see, the same similar pattern that the fungal community under the plants is completely different from that of the community in the waste rock. So the next question that Leah wanted to ask is, okay, the communities are different. There's a lot more biomass in the plant-influenced rock. The communities are completely different. But what kind of communities are present in each of these sites? Well, first we looked at that waste rock community. We did a process of amplicon sequencing, so that gives us a complete profile in the same fashion that Rainer presented earlier with the iron and sulfur oxidizers, but we were looking more for the nitrogen cyclers, the phosphate solubilizers, the organic carbon cyclers, all the different microbes that represent processes that plants need to release nutrients for their survival. The waste rock material was really characterized by what we call oligotrophs, which are those microbes that really don't need a lot of organic matter to survive, the kind of microbes you would see find in open oceans. We did not see any nitrogen. We saw very few organic carbon cyclers. And Leah chose in this slide to look at the specific groups of organisms that cycle nitrogen. And she found the relative abundance of all of those microbes. And what you can see in this slide is that in the unseeded area, on the far right in this box plot, the levels of those microbes are quite low as compared to over here on the left, the natural area. However, there is no statistically significant difference between the abundance of those organisms in the natural undisturbed area and in the shrub, the areas where shrubs are growing. So the shrubs have developed that microbial community of nitrogen cyclers to a level comparable to the offsite, and it's slightly higher than what we've seen in the grasses. So this is quite exciting information to us to understand that the process below ground is a process of plants being established. It's happening over a five-year period that we could witness. And what we saw as a snapshot in our first case study of nitrogen and biomass being important, we now in this study see a temporal increase of nitrogen and biomass development over time that appears to be accelerated by shrub coverage. Point number two in this list of summary points is that there is no significant above-ground plant establishment or below-ground fertility development on that unseeded waste rock after over six years of monitoring. So you really do need that hydroseeding if you want to get anything growing on waste rock. And again, the waste rock microbial community is not characterized by the kind of microbes that plants need for survival. So establishing those plants is also building that community. So we are developing ecosystem capacity in the process of seeding that waste rock. And again, that shrub establishment accelerates soil fertility development relative to grass establishment. So overall, what are the take-home points of this mined waste rock revegetation research that we're doing? First of all, the results from these studies provide metrics to monitor revegetation progress. So if you think back to those initial slides where you see failure, we now can take soil samples to try to understand the source of that failure and also when we need to intervene with additional management practices to help that revegetation to succeed. The second point is that our industry research partners have identified significant environmental areas of concern for our research development. And the future areas that we're going to look at are to develop metrics for evaluating that cover material so that we can identify what is an effective cover material. If a mine is excavating a borrow pit down to 60 or 70 feet in depth, can we tell them layers that they should avoid because they are going to be detrimental to rapid plant establishment? We also want to look at the significance of seeding time. Should in the arid regions, should you try to capture winter rains? Should you try to capture the summer monsoon? What is the best seeding time for effective plant establishment? And we also want to look at the possibility of adding microbial amendments to the hydroseeding mix to try to accelerate plant establishment. I'd like to briefly, at the end of my presentation, tell you more about the Center for Environmentally Sustainable Mining that Raina introduced. The goal of this center is to develop educational and research initiatives that address environmental issues related to mining activities in arid and semi-arid environments. And you've been given the website URL if you're interested in it. It has a technical advisory committee that informs and evaluates our activities and research priorities. And that committee is comprised of industry representatives from copper mining industries, from the rock products industry, and from consulting. And really what CESM does is it serves as a conduit for information transfer between academia and industry. It gives us a process to provide research translation to industry from academia, but more importantly, it gives industry an opportunity to inform our research objectives, as I've shown in these slides. And finally, it provides an avenue for neutral tech transfer to state and national policymakers and regulators such as the EPA so that maybe we can influence some of the regulatory guidelines that would help mines to implement more effective reclamation practices and environmentally sustainable practices. And then finally, I want to explain this CESM U of A Industry Academic Vegetation Research Cooperative, as we call it. It's a consortium of industries that fund the research that I have largely presented today and work in a cooperative sense. So the research that we do is conducted on multiple mining properties. And over the past 6 years, we've been funded by ASARCO Mission Mine, KGHM, Carlotta Copper, Resolution Copper, and BHP Copper. And the specific focus thus far has been to develop these below-ground biogeochemical indicators of revegetation progress so that they can be used as predictive tools both to evaluate the capping material and also revegetation progress. And our ultimate goal is to provide the mining industry with technological tools to make revegetation a data-driven science. We don't want to get, as you can see on this picture on the right, this kind of inconsistent patchy plant establishment. We would like the mining industry to have the tools to get consistent establishment and reproducible establishment. And I just want to conclude by thanking the huge number of people that have supported this research. I'm very excited by the number of students, postdocs, and staff that have driven this research because they've had the opportunity to work with industry and regulatory agencies to understand how reclamation work is a process of research translation between academia and collaboration with industry. We also have a diverse faculty group with expertise in plant genomics, in dust evaluation, in geochemistry, and in restoration ecology. And we've been funded by a diverse group of people that fund our students and also fund our research, both industry and the Superfund research program, as well as groups that have funded our graduate students. And I'd like to thank you very much for the time, and we would love to entertain your questions.
Great. Thank you, Julie and Raina, for your presentations. We've gotten a number of questions that have come in while you were speaking, and I just want to let you know we've also gotten a number of comments. Thank you for your wonderful presentation, and people were really enjoying the information you were sharing. I want to say that, Julie, I really enjoyed your comment that we want to make revegetation a data-driven science. I totally stand behind that, and I appreciate you saying that. So I'm going to start with a number of questions, and I think, Julie, I'll ask you a couple questions first. There's several people have been asking about if anything that you added to the soil to improve plant growth, such as fertilizer. Did you make any additions like that?
The hydroseeding mix used on the slopes typically has a tackifier. It has, depending on the cedar, it has sometimes a mulch. The drill seeding that was done on the flat surface on the mine tailings, there was mulch added at one end. One of the limitations of the research that I've presented thus far is that we came to the sites about 5 years after they had been established, and we could not get great information about exactly what was added. So we are kind of working backwards in terms of trying to understand what are the key amendments that need to be added. Are there amendments that could be added that would accelerate the process? So I don't really have a great answer to that question, but that is definitely the focus of our research moving forward with the mining industry. And I just can't compliment the mines that we're working with at this point enough for their collaboration and their interest in really trying to address those questions. But right now, we don't have a good grasp on what amendments really make significant differences. All we really understand mm-hmm. is the nature of the cover material makes a difference.
Okay. And another question about the soil amendments and other biomass that was added, and this question has come in during both of your presentations. Can you talk about what the general composition of those materials were or what the source of any organic matter was that you brought into the experiments?
I'm going to let Raina take that because she can answer that with the legacy site, which I think is important.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So for the legacy site, we used a composted dairy manure that we were able to get from a huge dairy operation in Phoenix. I will say that the addition of the compost was the most expensive thing that we bought for the project. And the compost itself, the characteristics of it, can actually be found in the references that you guys have listed on your site.
Okay, great. So when you mentioned that the manure was the most expensive, is it to actually purchase the product or to transport it?
Yes, we actually purchased it. and the transport is not necessarily cheap either, but we wanted a source that we could go back to if we had to and get the same thing over again. I think people could be very creative in the type of organic matter that is added to any site, and it should be based on what's locally available, which could be from food processing plants, from dairy or other animal operations, and green waste as well.
Right. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. So, Raina, a question came in when you were speaking about your plots and the irrigation. And this person wanted to know, are they still being irrigated, or were they irrigated and was it discontinued after the plants were established? A follow-up to that was, oh, go ahead, you can answer that part and then I'll ask you.
Okay. Yeah, so the plots were irrigated for as they needed it for the duration of the 6-7 year experiment. This experiment would not be able to continue itself without irrigation or further compost amendment. It was sort of a fundamental science question of could you with a compost amendment, in sort of the worst case scenario of this very low pH, very high metal materials, can you get plants to grow in it? And I think it probably is not a viable solution in the long term for these legacy sites, but I think what we've learned from it has so much application and is the foundation for all the work that Julie has been doing on these active sites.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to add that I think a fundamental difference between legacy and active operations is that when you're trying to inhibit that acid-generating process, that compost amendment not only provides a buffer, but it provides that microbial inoculum that, as Raina pointed out so nicely in that complicated heat map, that shuts down the activity of those iron sulfur oxidizers. In non-pyritic waste material, which is what the kind of material that I was demonstrating, you don't have to deal with that chemistry. You're just trying to get the microbial community there that can facilitate nutrient cycling for plants. And the plants can build that community themselves. We would like to understand through our research whether some of the inocula could accelerate that process. And that was why we have one research project going now looking at a mycorrhizal fungi inoculum. But it's a very different scenario, the two different problems, I guess, we're looking at.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And it working on both of these types of sites has really enhanced our thinking of the problem as a whole.
And there was another interesting question that came in about at some Superfund sites I've worked on, we've used biosolids from wastewater treatment. And I guess a question came in is, was there any consideration or did you look at multiple different amendments from different sources in addition to the manure that you used or considered it?
Yes, so we have certainly considered it, and again, I think that whatever is close by is a good thing. The one reservation I have about biosolids is that the organic matter in the biosolids is really much more available and turns over much more quickly than a mm-hmm. compost. And so I think that mixing the biosolids with a green waste would be a good thing. And we have done some experimentation on looking at such mixtures, but primarily looked at the composted dairy manure. So I think you have to think about the qualities of the compost and will they be good for the long term?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. Someone asked the question is if you have any comments about the longevity of stabilization in terms of how often soil amendments will need to be added, if it's in a range of years it might take for plants to get established so that they can support themselves so that we don't have to go back and continue to make these additions?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I am not quite sure. I think that for at the Iron King site, I would have loved to, at 4 or 5 years, do another addition and follow that. I think it might be for a site like Iron King, it might be for a very long time. I think for sites like the Julie's talking about, it's going to be much easier to walk away without further management. But when you have acid-generating potential, it's probably going to be a long-term management, decades.
I think you're right.
But I would like to add that it, you know, it's...
Yeah, it, please do.
Pardon? I was just going to add that it is a long-term management, but if what's amazing to see in southern Arizona, at least, is if you do nothing, nothing will grow there for hundreds of years. And so the alternative is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nothing will grow there, and it will continue to generate acid that will and be a source of metals for the surrounding ecosystems. So, yes, mm-hmm. it's a big management issue, but it needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. So, Julie, that's a really great point. And I actually think that when you talk about having to do yard removals, et cetera, the management associated with making sure that, you know, compost is added again or whatever is much cheaper than the alternative of going in after the fact and trying to clean up a bigger mess.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a good point. And then you remove it, and you're just moving the problem somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a question that is about plant uptake of the contaminants. Did you do any assessment of that? And, you know, the plants.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we've done a lot of assessment. We did. I'm sorry, the phone connection is kind of going in and out. Can you hear me?
Okay. I can hear you. Is there a problem on my end?
Yeah, I can only hear you sometimes.
It's your line. I'm watching the line. At this point, Raina, if you can hear Michelle's last question, go ahead and answer it, and then Michelle will just have you speak a little bit more slowly with each question as you read it, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
So in terms of plant uptake of metals, we did a pre-screening of desert-adapted plants prior to the greenhouse study even, and we chose plants that did not accumulate metals above the domestic animal toxicity limits. So there, you know, plants, some plants are very efficient at taking up and other plants do not take up. There's some really nice papers that we've been able to put out in conjunction with some of the environmental chemists that have worked that actually go to the mechanism of why plants exclude some metals. So it really depends. You have to be intelligent about the plants that you choose. And I think some, you know, work has to be done, again, on the long term to make sure that successional plants also don't take up the metals. There's some evidence that weathering of the metals in during a phytostabilization, it certainly does no harm. So we don't see any more leachability or bioavailability during the phytostabilization process. And in fact, there's evidence that some of these metals are incorporated into more stable phases that are less bioavailable during phytostabilization.
Okay. We had a question about the plant species. Were the shrub and grass species the same between the disturbed and undisturbed areas so that there's no transitional vegetation?
That's an excellent question, and that is an area of research that we are developing. We use some what we call pioneer species to grow on, especially on the waste rock, because the native vegetation in that area, it's a chaparral ecosystem, so there's oak, acacia, grasses, and some of the plant species that you see in the native area are not just going to grow as a pioneer species. So the pioneer species do well. They build fertility, and the idea is they will act through a process called facilitation to allow the native species from the area to eventually reseed that area. In the case of the tailing storage facility, number of the species there that grew were representative of area of plants that grow in the surrounding desert. I think it's a little bit less harsh in the sense that you've got a flat surface and maybe better water retention. However, we believe that you need a process of pioneer species prepping the soil to develop the fertility for the eventual development of the plant community from the surrounding area. But we also feel very strongly that you need to think what your end goal is for mine site reclamation. And I feel that one really important end goal in arid and semi-arid regions is just ecosystem establishment, carbon sequestration, get plants growing, because that end slope shows you what happens if you do nothing. You'll get nothing growing. And you may never, or it may take hundreds of years to get back to the native community, but still in 5 years you can get a stable ecosystem where you are sequestering carbon and you have plants growing. So we feel that it is a stepwise successional process, and we actually want to develop research in that area to find out what are the best pioneer species to help build that fertility, to build that microbial community and that mm-hmm. below ground fertility that's needed for the more slow-growing species to come in and seed.
Great. I think we have time for one more question. This one is a little different than the other, so I'll ask this one. When you're talking about your phytostabilization experiments, I guess this commenter was curious about the erosion and ponding increasing the acidification in the plots. And they wanted to know what was the extent of erosion and ponding in the experimental plots versus the control area, and was there any stormwater controls?
Yeah, so it's something we didn't plan for entirely. There's no difference between the plots and the control areas. They just get massive storms in that area sometimes, and we can see ponding that is, you know, up to half a foot in depth until it sort of drains away. And one of the management decisions that I would recommend in any phytostabilization process is that when you put your amendments into the tailings, that you make sure that the drainage is good. So that you can avoid any ponding. And I think if you can avoid ponding, you're going to avoid the re-acidification process and avoid the loss of vegetation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Did that answer the question?
Yeah, I just got a response saying thank you very much for all of this discussion and answering the question. So, our time is about up. I don't know, Raina and Julie, if you had any last comments that you wanted to make. I wanted to thank you very much for your presentation. I think it really sparked a lively conversation with our participants. So if you have any last comments, I'll give you a moment.
So I'd just like to thank everybody for listening. And I will speak for Julie. She and I are, you have our email addresses, and we would be happy to answer any questions afterwards.
Excellent.
Yes, thank you for everyone who's joined the webinar. And I am, being a resident of Southern Arizona, I'm very excited about the possibility of providing improved technology to the mining industry so that we really can realistically reclaim large tracts of land disturbed by mining. I think it is a goal within mm-hmm. our reach, and I'm excited about being part of the research effort to give the mining industry better tools to accomplish that goal. So that is something I'm very enthusiastic about, the support that we've had from consultants and the mining industry for this type of research. So thank you for organizing this webinar on the topic.
Great, yeah, thank you for joining us. And again, as you were making your last remarks, I just want to reiterate all the thanks that our participants are sending in right now, commenting how wonderful the presentation was, very interesting work, and we're just glad that you were able to present today. So thank you so much. We look forward to being able to share the archive with people in the future. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Jean Ballant, who will close us out for today's session.
All right. Thank you so very much, Michelle. I want to just point out just a few final reminders. So for those of you who are looking for the related URLs that are available on the middle right, as well as copies of the presentation material, we currently have those posted on a resources page. I highlighted that at the start of today's class. I've pasted that right on into the Q&A window. So if you're looking for those links and articles and their materials, we already have that available. You can visit those links and download them locally. If you're looking for contact information for our speakers and organizers, as noted, it's on their slides, but we also have that available on the seminar homepage. And I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. I've included that link as well in the Q&A. You'll find it on the middle right under the related resources window. For those of you that happen to be watching the recorded version of that webinar, those links are still active. You can still click the links and open them up, so you can even send in the feedback form and let us know what you thought of the archive. Now, the most common request I get as a facilitator is if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While we don't generate those types of credit hours, we can provide you with confirmation emails and seminar certificates. If you fill out that online feedback form and do two things, enter your email address correctly on that form and check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you either watched the whole thing or were here live for the entire session, as soon as you submit feedback, you'll have access to a participation certificate that you can save for your own records. If you happen to have a number of people joining at your location, each person can fill out that feedback form link, even if they didn't register individually, and get their own certificate. So if you did have others with you, I encourage you to share the link to the feedback form so they can send in their own feedback. And with that, again, I'll thank everybody for joining us and remind everybody that we'll send a follow-on email shortly in about 1 to 2 weeks as soon as the archive is available for on-demand playback. And with